Hi, Dave Emery here. Side 2, for the record, program number 783. Can you put lipstick on a Nazi? This is being recorded on March 23rd of the year 2014. The reference to that, of course, is to the old saying, you can put lipstick on a pig, but at the end of the day, it is still a pig. And what is taking place in the Ukraine is the putting of lipstick on the Nazi pig of the OUND heirs who dominate the Ukrainian government. For background, please examine not only the audio files, but the long article-length, meticulously documented written descriptions on the SpitfireList.com website. Look in the For the Record category. Now, we're going to continue right where we left off with the reading of this very important and very brave article, frankly, by George Eliason, or Eliason, E-L-I-A-S-O-N, from the Op-Ed News of March 16, 2014, The Nazis Even Hitler Was Afraid Of. And Mr. Eliason is going against the trend that holds forth these days. William Butler Yeats, the famous poet, observed that, quote, the best lack all conviction, while the worst are fired with a passionate intensity. And Mr. Eliason is willing to state and document some very uncomfortable truths. And we are going to continue with his article. Instead of apologies, the Ukrainian OUN Banderites and the UCCA offer apologetics and write handbooks on how to escape responsibility for their grievous crimes against humanity. They paint themselves quite literally as both victims and heroes, not as perpetrators. Ironically, one such handbook is titled Genocide, Never Again, the Teacher and Student Workbook printed by the UCCA, the Ukrainian Congressional Committee of America, on the 75th anniversary of the Ukrainian genocide. The never again in the title is, of course, the cry of people that managed to survive the genocide. Can it also be used by the people that committed it, unrepentantly? How can a group that unquestionably committed the most brutal torture and barbaric murder in World War II morph into champions of social justice? They continually deny involvement and try to convince the world of the same thing that they teach their own people. They were victims and heroes. At the same time, they glorify their SS heroes at will. The First Division link is their homage to the Galician SS. Typical UCCA Banderite propaganda looks like this. Quote, the only important OUN idea from the past that survived is a desire for a free and democratic Ukraine where all Ukrainians, regardless of their ethnic backgrounds, can live in peace, unquote. This response from a former Arizona UCCA state chapter president really needs to be considered in the light of history and present circumstances. That one statement says it all. The only question he leaves unanswered is, who is a Ukrainian? Do they include all families that have lived there for hundreds of years and speak Russian? How about people that do not support Bandera? On June 30th, 1941, Stefan Bandera declared the formation of the Ukrainian state in Lviv. Stefan Bandera made as his lieutenant Yaroslav Stetsko. Stetsko was installed as the premier. After the war, the Bandera groups formed their government in exile that was given quiet legitimacy by both the U.S. and the Canadian government shortly after World War II. This last sentence for emphasis. After the war, the Bandera groups formed their government in exile that was given quiet legitimacy by both the U.S. and the Canadian governments shortly after World War II. Part of this was due to their support during the Cold War against the Soviet Union, and part due to the size of their lobbying effort. They pumped a lot of money into Congress. They were legitimized by the U.S. That they were legitimized by the U.S. government is clear from all the released Nazi War Crimes Disclosure Act documents I have come across. Again, note that the Ukrainian Nazi government in exile was given legitimacy by the U.S. and Canadian governments. It basically was nurtured within the womb of elements of Western intelligence, and in particular the Republican Party and the Reagan administration. Ultimately, Rosemary's Baby, Ukrainian style, was delivered in the early part of the new century. Resuming again with George Eliason's narrative here. Speaking of the Ukrainian government in exile, they were legitimized by the U.S. That they were legitimized by the U.S. government is clear from all the released Nazi War Crimes Disclosure Act documents that I have come across. It is very clear that the most important branches of the diaspora government are in the U.S. and Canada. Until 2003, the exiled leadership of the Bandera government of Ukraine was only one step away from the person of Stefan Bandera himself. The supreme leadership of Bandera's ultra-nationalists worldwide changed hands twice after his assassination. Both supreme leaders had been his closest associates. The first was Yaroslav Stetsko, Bandera's premier in exile. He took over the control of the ultra-nationalist government in exile on the death of Stefan Bandera, and he held that position until his own death in 1986. Upon his death, his wife Slava Stetsko took over the leadership role and lived to bring home the worldwide movement to the Ukraine. Most recognizable Ukrainian politicians, including Viktor Yushchenko and Yulia Tymoshenko, are proteges of Slava Stetsko. This will explain why Mr. Yushchenko made Stefan Bandera a hero of Ukraine, unquote. The EU sharply objected to this at the time because of Bandera's involvement in genocide, and Viktor Yanukovych subsequently rescinded the award. That did not work out well for Mr. Yanukovych. The first-generation Bandera government, which pledged fidelity to Adolf Hitler and committed rampant and brutal genocide that it still denies, was alive and well until 2003. It ruled and raised funds from the Ukrainian diaspora, which constitutes a third of the Ukrainian population worldwide, or 20 million people. Today, the Kiev government is only the second generation of Bandera government. Looked at realistically, it still promotes the teachings, policies, and doctrines of Stefan Bandera, less than 10 years removed from their institutional moorings. The Bandera leaders of today were cultivated to make sure that they would not stray far. The present government in Kiev can also be counted on to be true to its history. One of the things happening now in Ukraine is forced Ukrainization. Again, I'm going to interrupt here. The editorials that have appeared, including in The Gray Lady, the New York Times, have dismissed President Putin's and the Russian claim that the government in Ukraine are not only Nazis, but are active Russophobes. Listen to the following and ask yourself as you listen to this, again, warts and all, given all of the warts on President Putin, what leader, what country would not react in that fashion if not only was it to be blocked from the Black Sea naval access, but who the hell would put up with this? Listen very carefully. Beginning again, one of the changes happening now in the Ukraine is forced Ukrainization. If you remember Nazi history and the Hitler Youth, you will understand what Ukrainization means. It demands the same unquestioning loyalty from little children, a loyalty even greater than that to family. What is forced Ukrainization at the preschool level? Irina Farion, F-A-R-I-O-N, was a favorite for the Minister of Education slot until a discussion behind closed doors in the Senate became public. Note here who instead got nominated, Sergei Kvit, K-V-I-T, from Trizhud, Dmitry Yarosh's core group, a real ultranationalist, got the nod instead. Here is Irina Farian speaking to a little child. Quote, "What is your name?" "Misha." "It's not Ukrainian. You are Mihailo." "And your name?" "Masha." "You are Marusa." "But my mom calls me this. If you want to be Masha, go to Moscow." "Don't call other children Russian names. It is degrading. It's like calling them an animal that lives in the woods and walks on all fours." Unquote. Imagine a government official speaking to children like this. Children are now taught that if they have Russian names, they are second-class citizens. All of the children of the Ukraine will grow up to be ultra-nationalists. Those instilled with National Socialism will get a better education, a better job, and a better life. South and East Ukraine do not want their children taught these things. Would you? Vladimir Putin and Russia are the only parties putting the brakes on that right now. The same Europe, by the way, this is George Eliason writing here. This is not me beginning again. South and East Ukraine don't want their children taught these things. Would you? Vladimir Putin and Russia are the only parties putting the brakes on that right now. The same Europe and the same America that 70 years ago violently overthrew the forces of bigotry and indoctrination are now saying that the Ukrainian people must accept them quietly. Dmitry Yarosh, Trizhub and Pravi Sektor, and Assistant Secretary of Defense and National Security. And listen to this. Again, this is me speaking now, interrupting. How would you react if you were the head of the Russian state listening to this, coming from people with this heritage? Beginning again, Dmitry Yarosh of Prizub and Pravi Sektor and Assistant Secretary of Defense and National Security. "It is better for us to build our own national state. Does that mean knives to the Moscows and ropes to the Jews? Well, not so unsophisticated. There must be a Ukrainian authority in the Ukraine. The titular nation must dominate in business, politics, and culture. Then, forced Ukrainization. Russians do not like it. Well, go back to effing Russia." And again, I'm attenuating this for broadcast purposes. "Those that don't want to go, we can help them. Russians are not even Slavs. Next, we will liberate our lands, Voronezh, Kursk, Belgorod, Oblast, and Kuban. These are all Ukrainian lands." The only problem is all of these oblasts or regions are in Russia. No, I am not talking about the U.S. and Russia. The spit propaganda that became Western media portrays this as Cold War redux. "Are you for the West? Good. You support democracy." Not so fast. The Russian invasion of Crimea took a turn for the weird yesterday. By the way, this is very important. I would note in this regard that both Pravi Sektor and Trizhub and Svoboda have a long tradition and an explicit tradition of street fighting and violence. Notice the following. One of the things that is just gnawing at me is the possibility of provocation with all that could result from that, including a Third World War. Listen to the following. The Russian invasion of Crimea took a turn for the weird yesterday. The Prime Minister of Crimea, Sergei Aksyonov, directed Crimea's volunteer militia to arrest any person they see that looks like a Russian soldier. Crimean authorities have heard that Pravi Sektor is masquerading as Russian soldiers trying to provoke conflict. The now official Ukrainian government organization tried to set off a bomb at a cafe in Crimea 2 days ago. This is not about East versus West. The choice is simpler than that. It is about life and death. There are no compromises to be made. If Kiev declares Stefan Bandera and all associated groups are illegal and genocided, beginning again, there are no compromises to be made. If Kiev declares Stefan Bandera and all associated groups are illegal and genocidal war criminals, the Southeast and the Ukraine will relax. But quite to the contrary, the first thing the Kiev government did was to make laws that legalized the teaching of Nazi propaganda. Without representation, they decided that 10% of people's pay in the Southeast would be taken without their consent and given as support to the families of people that overthrew a constitutional government. Ukraine is not West versus East. They want you to make the same decision with them. Are you for a world ruled by ultranationalists? Ukraine says no. Are you for a government that supports the doctrines of the Third Reich? Will you support one? Are you supporting one? If the Ukrainian government that was propelled into power is not ultranationalist, why are they making every move to show otherwise? Does the U.S. government support ultranationalist values? If not, why are they showing otherwise? Clarification starts with both governments adhering to the rule of law. Otherwise, as I once heard someone I respected put it, you can put lipstick on a pig, but at the end of the day, it is still a pig, unquote. And again, I think that is a very, very courageous and eloquent article by George Elias in an op-ed news. It states some extremely important things that we are not being told about here with our free press, unquote. And he says those things eloquently. And I don't think the importance of this story, and beyond that, the events that he is discussing, one of the very few people who will discuss it, its significance could not be exaggerated. And if these trends continue, I don't think that the possibility dismissed by so many of a Third World War could be rolled out. People didn't think 100 years ago that World War I would really turn into very much. It turned into quite a bit. And again, that article, The Nazis Even Hitler Was Afraid Of, by George Elias in Op-Ed News of March 16th of 2014. What we're going to look at now is the German support for Svoboda, the most dominant of the OUNB heirs now in the Ukraine. By the way, I would note in passing that with the U.S. and Canadian governments and also the German government having snubbly sanctioned the OUN Nazi government in exile, but in fact having incorporated those same elements into the Reagan administration, how can they then turn around and label the current government of the Ukraine as extremist? Note the following. This is from the venerable Der Spiegel. By the way, Der Spiegel, even though it contains some of the same sort of editorial slanting that the New York Times does, some of the best articles I have seen in the world media in the last several years have come from Der Spiegel, Germany's most respected news magazine. And this is a very important story, although some of the most important parts are relatively short. From Der Spiegel of March 17th of 2014, an article by Stefan Winter, W-I-N-T-E-R, Tight on the Right, Germany's NPD Maintains Close Ties to Svoboda. Now, this headline is somewhat deceptive because although it does document the very close ties between the NPD, the top neo-Nazi party in Germany, and Svoboda, it also talks about the support for and the networking with Svoboda by not only prominent German NGOs, but also elements associated with and belonging to the German government of Angela Merkel. The article reads, when Holger Apfel showed up at the Saxony State Parliament with a parliamentary delegation, unquote, from Ukraine last May, few had even heard of a party called Svoboda. Apfel, APFEL, was head of the right-wing extremist National Democratic Party of Germany, or NPD, at the time, proudly showed his guests, Ukrainian parliamentary Mikhail Golovko and two municipal politicians from the Ukrainian city of Ternopil, around the parliament building in Dresden. Speaking to other NPD parliamentarians, Apfel called the nationalist Svoboda Party, quote, one of the most important European right-wing parties, unquote. And skipping down in this article, after talking more about the NPD networking with Svoboda, given such ties, it is astounding that Germany has approached the Ukrainian right-wing extremists in a manner that would be unthinkable with the NPD. On April 29, 2013, for example, Germany's ambassador in Kiev met with Svoboda's parliamentary floor leader Oleg Tianabuk. During the meeting, Berlin has insisted, the ambassador exhorted Tianabuk to respect the inviolability of human dignity and human rights. But the Ukrainian right wing has also received instruction financed by German taxpayers. Party members appeared at events hosted by the Konrad Adenauer Stiftung, the German political foundation affiliated with Chancellor Angela Merkel's conservatives. Examples include the conference entitled Lessons from the 2012 Parliamentary Elections, unquote, the seminar series called The Higher School of Politics, unquote, and a discussion on the 2012 elections. Even the German Society for International Cooperation, or GIZ, has supported the Svoboda Party. GIZ oversaw a project for the, quote, formation of administrative capacities in the public financing sector, unquote. Svoboda parliamentarians took part in two trips to Berlin in 2013 in conjunction with the project. One prominent party member even gave an interview in early May of 2013 to the NPD publication Deutsche Stimme. And the article goes on to note how Svoboda has been honoring the SS and also being honored by it, and then adds, returning to Spiegel's text, Svoboda, meanwhile, has established chapters in Frankfurt, Cologne, and Munich. So Svoboda is opening chapters in Germany. They've also opened some in Canada as well. And one of the things to note as we observe what is taking place in Ukraine is the fact that 25% of all of the proven natural gas reserves on the planet Earth are in the Ukraine. Quickly, from Yahoo News of March 6th of 2014, this oil giant could get crushed by Ukraine. It's by Lawrence Lewitin, L-E-W-I-T-I-N-N. Once known as the breadbasket of Russia, Ukraine is now also Russia's fuel tank, and one American company has 10 billion reasons to hope nothing goes wrong. Ukraine sits on 39 trillion cubic feet of natural gas reserves. That's about one quarter of the world's entire proven natural gas reserves. And more about the natural gas in the Ukraine and the implications of the reabsorption of Crimea into Russia proper for the extraction of that natural gas. This is an article from Natural Gas Europe of March 12th of 2014. It's by Andreas Genei, J-E-N-E-I, titled The Bear Steps In, a Russian Thriller. And it reads in part, Russian control over the Crimean Peninsula, beside the fact that it would solve the ethnic problem and the question of the fleet, would create a brand new situation regarding the oil and gas market because the stakes are high. If Crimea falls under Russian authority, parenthetically it obviously has since this article was written, Russia will be able to greatly expand its borders on the Black Sea, among others, to the three enormous oil and gas fields that can be found next to Crimea. Furthermore, there is a tremendous amount of gas under the shallow waters of the Sea of Azov, A-Z-O-V, as there are fields with great potential to the southeast and to the west of Crimea as well. Each one of the hydrocarbon locations can be found on the shallow continental shelf, which has the advantage of the significantly cheaper extraction of the oil and gas there compared to the deeper parts of the Black Sea. American and Italian companies have concessions in these territories, but their claims were made with the Ukrainian state, and the creation of a Russian enclave similar to Kaliningrad would create a rather sensitive legal situation. Additionally, the Ukrainian leadership knows well the importance of these territories, as beside the unconventional terrestrial utilization of natural gas, the Black Sea locations form one of the keystones of their energy strategy. And I would note in this regard that it says Kiev will fight for the Crimean Peninsula tooth and nail. I would note that in addition to the people networking with Svoboda, that includes Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel, and we find that in the following article from the New York Times of March 20th, 2014. NATO weighs assistance for Ukraine to dissuade further moves by Moscow. And talking about that, the potential military assistance for Svoboda and the Pravi sector, just think about that one, okay? Mr. Hagel spoke by phone with his Ukrainian counterpart, Ihor Tenyuk, T-E-N-Y-U-K-H, and I know that is from Svoboda, as he is a member of Svoboda, as we looked at in For the Record 780. One more thing to note, Crimea has a large population of Tatars. They are a Turkophone Islamic people. There also is a presence in the Crimea of Hizb ut-Tahrir. That's a Muslim Brotherhood offshoot with links not only going to Al-Qaeda but to the pan-Turkist movement. One of the things to be careful about, to be wary of here, is the possibility of Pravi sector or Svoboda, agent provocateur, posing as Russians, performing acts of violence against the Crimean Tatar community in hopes of provoking a jihadist uprising there. I think that is a very clear and present danger. This concludes Side 2, For the Record program number 783, Can You Put Lipstick on a Nazi? This has been recorded on March 23rd of the year 2014. I'm Dave Emery. Ciao.